From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame welcomes its new inductees on Monday. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from two of them. Singer and poet Patti Smith got her start in the punk movement of the 1970s. She has an upcoming album of covers. And Michael Stipe of the band R.E.M., one of the pioneers of alternative rock, is here too. R.E.M. has a new CD that collects their work from 1982 to 1987. And film critic David Edelstein reviews 300, adapted from a graphic novel about an ancient battle between the Spartans and the Persians. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. With the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductions right around the corner, we're continuing our salute to some of the musicians being saluted by their peers at Monday's ceremony in New York. Today's guests are Michael Stipe, lead singer of R.E.M., and pioneer punk poet Patti Smith. We'll visit with Michael Stipe in the second half of the show. But by means of introduction to Terry's interview with Patti Smith, let's hear what he had to say about the influence Patti had on him when he was younger. He spoke with Terry in 1998.
Now, I think that Patti Smith is perhaps among the few women in rock music who not only inspired other women to enter music, but inspired men too. I think men are kind of usually inspired by men in music to go into music, especially in rock. You know, there's this, always this big division in rock between, you know, the male thing and the female thing. So I'm wondering what it was like for you to be so inspired, you know, by a woman.
It didn't, I mean, I think there were definitely sexual elements to it, but it didn't make a difference to me that she was a woman. She was very androgynous.
Right.
And, the thing about her, I think, is that she was incredibly sexy, but she was very sexy as a woman. She was also very sexy as a man. She was, you know, she just kind of like blurred all those lines in a way that I don't think we had seen before, certainly from a female performer. And it didn't matter whether she was a man or a woman. It was in the music. It was in the energy of the songs and the words and what she was, she was just so directly tapped into the source. And it was so glaringly obvious when compared to the other music that was around and that was available, that this person had tapped into something that was very uncommon. Also, I mean, for me, the song on Horses that really did it was Birdland, and that was just that was musically that took me to a place that I had never been to in my life.
Well, maybe go ahead.
I'll never forget the experience of hearing that for the first time, and I think. I mean, I know that, you know, in my heart, and I can speak for my band on this one, that, you know, when we make records, we want the same thing for whoever's out there listening to it. I want it to take them somewhere that they've never been before, and I want them to, like, have had some kind of experience that has some impact on them, and hopefully a good one, you know. It's, in a way, kind of passing the baton.
But no. Nobody heard the boys cry of alarm. Nobody there, except for the birds around the New England farm. And they gathered in all directions like roses they scattered. And they were like compass grass coming together into the head of a shaman bouquet. Slit his nose and all the others went shooting. At his cheeks, taking at his neck, all his limbs, everything was twisted, and he said, won't give up, won't give up, don't let me give up, I won't give up, come here, let me go up fast, take me up quick, take me,
That's the Patti Smith song Michael Stipe loved so much. Now, here comes Patti Smith herself. Patti Smith is being honored by the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, mostly for the pioneering punk rock work she recorded in the 1970s. Yet every decade or so, she has resurfaced with a dynamic new CD. Her brand new one, an inspired collection of cover versions, is called 12. It comes out next month. And in 1996, when Terry spoke with her, Patti Smith had just released a CD called Gone Again, dealing with the grief she was feeling at the time over the loss of her husband, her brother, and her friend, the artist Robert Mapplethorpe. Before we get to Terry's interview with her, here's a song from that album, My Madrigal.
Rendezvous.
That's Patti Smith from her new CD, Gone Again. Patti Smith, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you back.
Thank you.
I think some of the songs on this CD are really unlike some of the songs you've done in the past, such as the song we just heard, My Madrigal. There's an emotional straightforwardness in this song, and that almost chant quality of Till Death Do Us Part that I just find different from your previous work. Do you feel like you're writing out of a different kind of energy now?
Well, definitely. Well, Horses, a lot of the material in Horses was gleaned from 4 or 5 years' work before it was recorded. So I really started working on the work that came out on Horses when I was about 21 years old. So naturally, a lot of the work encompasses a lot of the anarchistic adolescent energy of a, you know, sort of a late blooming 22-year-old. So, you know, and subsequent records were really involved in, pursuits, artistic pursuits, involved in exploring language, exploring the sonic areas of the electric guitar, exploring the alchemy of live performance with my band members. So I was, and my concerns were different. You know, I was concerned with censorship, with the continuum of rock and roll as being a grassroots art form with global communication. And at this time in my life, my concerns were really a lot more basic. My concerns have to do with survival, pretty much, on Gone Again. And so.
Till Death Do Us Part, I'm assuming, of course, is about the loss of your husband. How long did it take before you started writing songs about his death?
Well, actually, not the first month. I really think I really started writing a little more than a month after he passed away, when my brother passed away. That actually had a different type of effect on me. My brother was the same age as Fred. They were both 45. My brother was a very, very supportive, high-spirited, youthful man. And he loved to see me work. He was, in the last month of his life, trying to help me get back on my feet and encouraging me to get back to work and get back to performing and songwriting. And he said that he would help me. And my brother was the head of my crew in the Patti Smith group. And he did encourage me and fill me with a certain amount of energy. So when my brother passed away, all of the energy that he put into me, all of that encouragement, all of that love, I didn't want to go in vain. And so I picked myself up and began to work really hard after my brother passed away.
Patti Smith, speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Terry's 1996 conversation with Patti Smith, whom the New York Times once called the godmother of punk. She's being inducted this year into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Now, I know when you were young, you were a Jehovah's Witness for several years. Was that the religion of your parents or something that you joined independently?
My mother's religion. Mm-hmm. I was a Jehovah's Witness till I was about 12. And in those days, Jehovah's Witnesses were stricter about one's pursuits outside of being a witness. And I decided I wanted to be an artist. I went to the Philadelphia Museum of Art with my father and saw art in person and immediately wanted to become a painter. And it some of the my desires sort of collided with their teachings. So I made the choice. I left the Witnesses to become an artist. I think they're a much more benevolent and more understanding group right now. And but at that time, I didn't get any sympathy or encouragement for that kind of way of life. So I my drive to be an artist was extremely strong as a 12 or 13-year-old.
And did you try other organized religions, or was that the end of organized religion for you for some time?
No, I looked in, I thought of, for a while I wanted to be Jewish, but I think that was my Anne Frank period. I didn't realize that you just can't be, you know, you don't turn Jewish. Well, I had great sympathy. I mean, when I grew up, you know, in the late 50s and early 60s, there was, you know, of course, a lot of information came out about the Holocaust, and there were trials and things, and I felt devastated about that as a young girl, and I got very interested in the Jewish faith. But I never really, I think once I left my first organized religion, I found, as I checked each one out, that really wasn't for me, because I really don't like the idea of exclusion. You know, I think all people, you know, return to God or whatever God is, or the energy of God. And I think all manners to get to Him, whether it's, you know, through Islam, or whether one's a Buddhist or a Christian or a Catholic, or I think they're all beautiful. You know, really.
What's the nature of your faith now? Are you in an organized religion?
Oh, no. No, not at all. I say my prayers and continue my studies. But I basically, for me, I don't really prescribe or need a religion. What's important to me is my communication with what I perceive to be God.
Now, what a lot of people might find confusing or paradoxical is, on one hand, this kind of spiritual inclination you've had since childhood and never stopped having, and at the same time, your art is the kind of art a lot of people would describe as blasphemous.
Well, I think blasphemy is just a form of exploring, you know, it's just a, you know, youthful, exuberant manner of exploring the whole concept. I think I've often found the people that are the most blasphemous are often the wind up to be the truest believers, because they've taken the time actually to question, pull things apart, be angry, and then either submit or, you know, find certain answers. A lot of people misconstrued, for instance, the statement, "Jesus died for somebody's sins but not mine."
Right.
People constantly came up to me and said, "You're an atheist. You don't believe in Jesus." And I said, obviously, I believe in him. I've stated, you know, I've made a statement, you know, which, you know, I'm saying that, you know, the concept of Jesus I believe in. I just wanted the freedom. I wanted to be free of him. I was 20 years old when I wrote that, and it was sort of my youthful manifesto. In other words, I didn't want to, I guess I didn't want to be good, you know, and I didn't want to, but I didn't want him to have to worry about me, or I didn't want him taking responsibility for my wrongdoings or my youthful explorations. I wanted to be free. So it's really a statement about freedom.
Well, that line comes up in a couple of places. It opens up your recording of Gloria. Mm-hmm. And it's also in a poem that you wrote in the early 70s called Oath.
Yeah, well, that's where it came from.
Yeah.
I wrote it like in 1970 and used it
in Gloria.
And really, it just evolved that way. A lot of the work on horses was not preconceived. It's just I started out as a performing poet. And when Lenny and Richard Soul were working with me, a lot of the poetry began to evolve and merge with music. And so a lot of horses has to do with the chemistry between Lenny, Richard, and I. and how they helped me further evolve my poetry.
Now, when you were young, did you feel set apart from other kids
Definitely.
Your age?
Definitely.
By what?
Everything. Well, I was just physically, I was kind of, I felt sort of like an ugly duckling. I was sort of like skinny and clumsy and not very athletic. I had a lot of guts, though, and I was a fast runner. But I was sick a lot. You know, I had scarlet fever and measles and mumps. I was always had something and a little frail. But I also was the oldest of three children, so I had a lot of responsibility. I don't know. I just generally felt estranged, but not only estranged from the other kids. I felt estranged from the planet. And truthfully, I spent most of my childhood believing that I was adopted by my parents and I was actually an alien.
Like from another planet?
Yeah, I know it sounds fun, but I perceived an alien. I used to have this idea that I was sort of like part of like this alien race that were part Venus and part American Indian. Now, this sounds kind of funny now, but I was very serious about it as a child. I had a whole cosmology and a whole universe formed around these thoughts. But I definitely didn't feel at home on the planet. I felt much more at home when I'd read books about the Aztecs or or if I'd read stories about aliens on other planets, or I didn't really feel like I belonged.
Now, I know your parents didn't have a lot of money, but if you were, say, middle class or like upper middle class.
A lower middle class.
Right. If you were like upper middle class, you probably would have been sent to a psychiatrist for help.
Well, not by my parents. I don't think so. No, I wasn't a child in pain or anything. I was actually proud of my secret of my secret
heritage.
Heritage. No, it wasn't like that. I wasn't a disturbed child. Mm-hmm. I was actually had a happy childhood. I loved my brother and sister. We were inseparable. They thought the world of me, and I found something my brother wrote after he passed away about our childhood, and he talks about how I was like King Arthur and they were the knights in my court. And they always believed in me, and I invented endless games and stories and plays for us to be involved in. And my parents were, my mother was, they were both hardworking, but my mother was always loving and creative, and she just had a lot of magic. I mean, my dad was on strike and we had no food or very little food, you know, she'd like make us like Wonder Bread with butter and sugar. And she'd like tell a story and this would become a great delicacy. We'd pretend we were all hiding out, you know, like hiding out from like the Nazis or something. And we hadn't eaten in 3 days and this was our food. And it was so wonderful. She made everything into a game. And, I had a great, those private thoughts I had were part of my creative energy or mm-hmm. the complexity of my mind. But I wasn't a disturbed child. I was just a little offbeat, I guess.
Patti Smith speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. We'll continue Terry's conversation with Patti Smith in the second half of the show. And we'll also hear from Michael Stipe, whose group REM will be joining Patti Smith in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Here's something from Patti's new CD of covers, which will be released next month. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Space. Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel, Night and Day, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, sponsoring Philadelphia's new audio walking tours called Sound About Philly at soundaboutphilly.com. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview with singer and poet Patti Smith, and we hear from Michael Stipe of the band R.E.M. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new graphic film 300, based on a graphic novel by Frank Miller and Lynn Varley.
If you can just get your mind together, then come on across to me. We'll hold hands and then we'll watch the sunrise from the bottom of the sea. Are you experienced? Have you ever been experienced? Well, I have. Well, I know you probably scream and cry that your little world.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. Let's return to Terry's 1996 conversation with Patti Smith, whom the New York Times once called the godmother of punk. She's one of this year's inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Now, you wrote for several years before actually performing in a rock and roll kind of setting and performing with music. When you started putting the two together, did you have any idea that you could sing? Had you used your voice that way before?
No, not really. I mean, I used to daydream when I was a kid about being an opera singer, and I loved Maria Callas, and my mother's a really nice singer. She, you know, had sort of like a 30s-style jazz voice, and my father had a nice voice, but I never thought about singing. I think I sang in the school choir or something, but I didn't really excel or have any real gift. But what I did have, I think, always was I've always, for some reason, been comfortable talking in front of people or performing in front of people. And I guess I got a lot of guts, but I never really had that great a voice. I think it's basically guts.
Well, speaking of guts, when you first started reading, you've said that you were reading, you know, early on, often in bars that weren't places if you would be likely to hear a poet.
No, they weren't.
What kind of places did you read in before you started
wherever I could, you know, I wasn't really accepted in the poet clique. I didn't have a lot of respect for poets, and I thought most of the poets, the more academic way of breaking into the poetry circle. It wasn't interesting to me. I didn't really relate to them, and I thought most of the poetry readings I went to were boring, and it just wasn't my scene. So I started pursuing different venues to perform my poetry, and I just read anywhere that anybody would take me, usually for free, just to get the experience, or for $5 or $10. And sometimes I'd be the opening act. You know? So I played like in a bar that had like a little rock band and some little blues band, and I go on before the blues band, and you know, nobody was interested in what I had to say. You know, they weren't interested in hearing poetry, or you know, they wanted to hear music and they were half drunk or whatever. But I figured if I had, they told me I had 15 minutes or 20 minutes on that little stage, that was my stage and I was going to fight for it. So I usually spent, if I had 20 minutes, 14 minutes arguing that I had the right to be there.
Arguing with with the audience?
Yeah, and then finishing with Piss Factory. And which usually I did such a strong reading of it that it would take them off guard and they'd kind of like it. And then I was gone. But
what was the arguing with them like?
Like sparring, you know, like the I can't, you know, like get a job, go in the kitchen where you belong. And, you know, I was really good at sparring. I really loved Johnny Carson and I really studied his whole monologue thing and the way Johnny Carson would go back and forth with the audience. And that was actually more in my mind of what I wanted to do, sort of be like Johnny Carson.
What was it like for you to create yourself on stage, to find out who you were on stage?
Well, I never really felt like I created myself because I'm the kind of performer that, you know, I roll out of bed, whatever I put on, you know, I roam the streets for a few hours, it's time for the job, and I go to the job. I don't like do any special type of thing. You know, I might meditate with my band for a few minutes before we go on, but my task as a performer was the opposite. I always have worked to strip away the idea of a stage persona.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, what happens when I'm on stage is a lot of the different things within me. Of course, because it's such a high-intensity situation, are somewhat magnified. You know, so if one has some rage within them, that rage is magnified. But it's the same as if one has benevolence or silliness. You know, so like a night, one of our concerts from the very beginning in 74 till even now, is just, you know, an evening of you know, myself and the people. And I always think it's all of our responsibilities to find out, you know, what the night's going to be made of. I'm not really interested in finding, like, out about who I am. I'm more interested in finding how we can best serve the night together.
When you looked at other people in rock, men and women, was there anybody who you particularly felt a kinship to in terms of what they were like on stage and the kind of energy they gave off?
Well, when I was younger, I mean, I never thought that I'd ever be involved in be a performer in the arena of rock and roll. I mean, I was raised, you know, and when I was raised, you know, when you saw females in the music business, they were all either like a lot of square white girls, you know, who were good singers and stuff, but like Leslie Gore or Sandra Dee and people like that, or you saw really great singers like Darlene Love and people like that, but they were singers. And performance-wise, somebody like Tina Turner, but I couldn't possibly compare myself to someone of her magnitude. I pretty much just liked, you know, I looked at rock performers really is a masculine, you know, I was raised that, you know, all the great rock performers were guys, you know, from, I mean, I loved, you know, Jimi Hendrix and I liked the Rolling Stones and Jim Morrison and Bob Dylan and people like that. I mean, even somebody like Elvis Presley. I mean, I just like a committed performer.
Let me play the first track of your first LP, and this is Gloria. What made you decide to rework this song?
Well, truthfully, it was in the beginning, it was just Lenny and I, and then we brought in a piano player who was Richard Soul. He was quite young, quite gifted. He was actually a classical piano player, but he had a great sense of rhythm. So it was just the three of us, a guitar, piano, and I, and we did very simple songs because the configuration was so simple. And we just chose songs that were basically three chords so I could improvise over them. Because I didn't want to just, like, do songs, you know.
Right.
I didn't want to do, like, lame approximations of songs. So what we did
is... Patti Smith covers the hits.
we did what we called field work, you know. So we'd pick songs that had basically three chords that I could, like, and just sort of use them as a springboard. I didn't really have any interest in covering Gloria, but it had three chords, and I liked the rhythm, and we just sort of used it for our own design, the same as Land of a Thousand Dances. Land of a Thousand Dances became really like a battleground for all kinds of adolescent excursions. And so that's why we picked songs like that. I remember I had to write, I wrote the ad copy for our first album, and the ad copy I wrote for Horses was three chords merged with the power of the word.
That's great, and yeah.
That was our philosophy.
Patti Smith, talking to Terry Gross in 1996. She's being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on Monday. That's from Patti Smith's 1975 album, Horses. Coming up, another Hall of Fame honoree, Michael Stipe of REM. This is Fresh Air. Now, as promised, let's hear more from Michael Stipe, whose group REM is another Rock and Roll Hall of Fame honoree this year. REM was formed in 1980. For years, the group was categorized as alternative rock and popular mostly on college radio. Then the group hit the mainstream, big time, with such hits as Losing My Religion, Everybody Hurts, and Stand. Terry spoke with Michael Stipe in 1998. Here's REM's hit song Radio Free Europe from their 1983 album, Murmur.
in some of the REM recordings over your year over the years, your voice is mixed kind of deep into the music,
yeah.
as opposed to being up front in front of the music.
Yeah.
And I you know me personally
that's my insecurity coming out again. You know,
is it?
Well, yeah, and I you know, at the time in the early 80s, everyone was mixing the drums louder than the vocal, and I just thought that was really embarrassing. We didn't want to be a disco band, and I was somewhat reacting to the music of the day, but I was also just kind of embarrassed because I'd never really, you know, the thought process of being a singer, being in a band, putting out a record, and then it's like, oh, whoops, well, I've got to write words because people expect words, and then, oh, well, the words should make sense, and I mean, if you listen to our records, the first really three or four records, including Chronic Town, you're basically watching four guys learn how to write songs, and you're watching me learn how to write a lyric. And I find that kind of fascinating. You know, those records mean a whole lot to a lot of people. Sometimes they're a little hard for me to listen to, but I do appreciate them for what they are.
Right. I'm wondering if you were influenced by any soul singers, too.
I think I must have been, but I can't think of anybody right on. My growing up as a child, my parents were not huge music fans. It was like a lot of Gershwin and Mancini and the 1812 Overture with real cannons and what else?
Well, your father's in the military.
The Sound of Music, yeah.
But
we lived in Texas for a stint, and mm-hmm. There was country radio, and that was bubblegum, when bubblegum pop radio was really big, and so that was certainly an influence. I didn't really have an older brother or sister that turned me on to the Beatles and turned me on to the Who and turned me on to all the music of the 60s. I kind of discovered stuff via radio as a child, and then really up until I found that magazine article and heard Horses, I was just kind of coasting along. I mean, I think before that, the only one musical artist that I thought was really interesting was Elton John. When Benny and the Jets came out, I thought that was one of the most amazing, and I still do. For me, Benny and the Jets and Rock On by David Essex are two of the most amazing. They'd be in my top 10 of best pop songs ever.
Now, I know because your father was in military, you moved around a lot as a kid, mm-hmm. as he got transferred to different military bases. What impact did it have on you to always be the new kid in the neighborhood?
Well, the positive aspects are that my family and I are very close, and when you're forced to make new friends fairly regularly, it kind of brings you together as a unit. I hate that word. Well, anyway, we were a great loving family and very close, and we still are, and that's about the greatest gift that could ever be given to me.
Let me play another REM track, and I think I'll choose one of your most famous recordings, your big hit, Losing My Religion. Is there a story behind this song?
Yeah. I was embarrassed about it at the time, but I finally fessed up to being a huge fan of the song Every Breath You Take by The Police. And I thought that song was like really kind of an intense, it was a beautiful pop song, and it was very lovely and but you could take it more than one way. It seemed very kind of creepy and obsessive on one hand, and very kind of like intense and loving on the other hand. And I wanted to write a song that was like that. So I wrote Losing My Religion.
Okay, well, this is it.
Trying to keep up you, and I don't know.
That's R.E.M. My guest is lead singer and songwriter Michael Stipe. You know, I think a lot of people have a personal story to tell about that song, particularly about the lines, "Oh no, I've said too much, I haven't said enough." I think a lot of people have stories about times when they really weren't sure about whether they've said too much or said enough. Do you have a story that matches with those lines?
Well, no, I didn't really take it from any real life situation. I just think it was more about fear of rejection, you know, and when you're like really crazy about somebody and you want to tell them, but you're trying to give them hints and then they're maybe not getting it, or they're saying something back to you and you're taking it the wrong way. And that's really, it's that kind of weird, uneasy area is what that song kind of covers.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very successful. I really like the song a lot.
Oh, me too. I'm glad you still like it. A lot of people get tired of their own hits. Then they get angry with you if you play them.
Yeah, no. It's a good song.
And you still play it in performances?
We try to. Yeah, we do.
That's Losing My Religion by R.E.M. and Michael Stipe speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. His group R.E.M. and Patti Smith are some of the inductees at this year's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Coming up, David Edelstein on the movie 300. This is Fresh Air. The comic book writer and artist Frank Miller became widely influential in the 1980s after two series, Daredevil and the dark and scary Batman Returns. In 2005, Robert Rodriguez's film of Miller's Sin City used the artist's comic panels as storyboards. Now comes 300, another extremely faithful Miller adaptation, which is being released as a film and a PlayStation game. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The computer-generated beefcake extravaganza 300 is about as bad as anything I've ever seen, but it's worth talking about because it's the future, a movie with a digitized cast of hundreds of thousands that could have been shot in a walk-in closet in Burbank, a movie that looks as synthetic as a video game, except you don't get to have your own joystick, a movie that, as drama, takes us back to the silent era in all the wrong ways. It's another telling of the story of the battle in 480 BC, in which 300 Spartans held off a million-man Persian army, led by the blood-drunk god-king Xerxes, at a pass they called the Hot Gates. The publicity bills this as, quote, a line in the sand for democracy, although these Spartan Democrats are shown chucking babies that are less than perfect physical specimens into a pit. The movie would have us understand that this is the kind of cruel sacrifice a warrior nation must make to preserve its liberty. It's no wonder the adjective Spartan has come to mean not just warlike, but stripped down, austere. In some ways, though, 300 is the least Spartan movie I've ever seen. Its vistas and effects are all computer-generated, its costumes color-coordinated, and its rippling male physiques more or less interchangeable. The Purple Prose visuals do make some aesthetic sense. The director and writer, Zack Snyder, is attempting to capture the frames of Frank Miller's 1999 graphic novel the way Robert Rodriguez did with Miller's Sin City. I was a fan of Sin City. I loved its pulpy paperback compositions and its over-the-top splatter and the fact that it didn't pretend to be anything but a sleazy gut-bucket revenge fantasy. 300, though, is meant to ennoble and inspire and to infuse its couch-potato audience with a lust for Persian blood. Here's the great Leonidas, the military king of the city-state, played by Gerard Butler, shouting down an appeaser who thinks that insurmountable odds are not a good enough reason to leave the field.
Spartans! Prepare for glory!
Glory? Have you gone mad?
There is no glory to be had now. Only retreat or surrender or death.
Well, that's an easy choice for us, Arcadian. Spartans never retreat. Spartans never surrender.
Go spread the word. Let every Greek assembled know the truth of this.
Let each among them search his own soul.
And while you're at it, search your own.
Okay, it's probably not fair to represent 300 with dialogue alone. You have to envision it with men so over-muscled they can barely walk, striking poses that would make Arnold Schwarzenegger snicker. And since they all appear to have worked out on the same equipment, it's hard to tell one set of swollen pecs from the next. Even weirder, though, is the action. It's fluid, but in that artificial video game way in which gravity is just a suggestion. First, the action goes in very, very fast motion as the hero and a Persian whack away at each other. Then, as the hero's sword makes contact, the image freezes. Then you get a lyrical slow-motion shower of bejeweled blood and the slow-motion fall into the camera of the now-beheaded enemy. Then it's fast motion again as the hero engages the next overmatched Persian. And all this with a throbbing video game rock backbeat and a lot of frat house bellowing. 300 will have its fans. I know several people who say, in slightly defensive tones, "I liked it. I didn't expect to." And I'm not just being patronizing when I say that I envy them their innocence. It would be fun to give oneself up to this synthetic lunkhead universe, even to enjoy the movie as camp. I did relish the plush Lena Headey as Leonidas's wife, no tolerant Penelope, but a firebrand capable of plunging a dagger into a political foe and of directing her husband in the bedroom with lines like, "Your lips can finish what your fingers have started." But I'm frankly not in the mood these days for overly engorged celebrations of the pictorial beauty of bloodletting. 300 is for armchair warriors who want to leave the theater even less connected to the real world than they were when they went in.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Podcasts of Fresh Air are now available at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from the Joyce Foundation, dedicated to protecting the Great Lakes, fresh water at the heart of America, joycefdn.org. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching, at breakthroughcollaborative.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalists Lisa Chetikal and Matthew Kaufman. They've won a George Polk Award for their series about the military's flawed mental health system. They found that the military relies on psychotropic medications to keep service members in combat, and that soldiers with PTSD are being sent back into battle. Join us for the next Fresh Air.